This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Also, what we see is that these products become more affordable to children. For example, by single-use vape sticks, as they are called, they are more affordable. They usually don't bear any health warnings, and children often don't know that they contain nicotine and are dangerous.
That's WHO Medical Officer Kerstin Shoti, who says the tobacco industry entices young people to become new users by providing addictive nicotine products. Details coming up. Also, Egypt's foreign minister says his government is working closely with partners to negotiate an end to the Sudan conflict. And the United States is temporarily stopping assistance to Gabon after the military took charge. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Egypt's foreign minister, Mr. Hassan Shawki, says his government is working closely with partners such as Saudi Arabia, the United States, and the African Union to try to negotiate an end to the conflict in Sudan. The fighting between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed thousands of civilians and forced more than 3 million people to flee their homes. Tens of thousands of them have fled to Egypt. In an interview with VOA's Peter Cloete, Foreign Minister Hassan Shawki discusses the Sudan conflict and efforts to end it.
Well, we have been applying our relationships to our Sudanese brethren, our contacts with all of the participants, whether in the military or in the civilian component, primarily in the military, to instill the importance of reaching a ceasefire in dealing with the humanitarian consequences of this conflict and in moving towards a broader dialogue that can chart a roadmap for a future and lead to elections and a stable and a unified government for Sudan that preserves the interests of its people, it preserves its territorial integrity, and provides the traditional role of Sudan to play an active role within the context of its African association to Eastern Africa, to the African Union. We continue to do so. President Sisi initiated the summit of the neighbors of Sudan. We have met as foreign ministers in N'Djamena to formulate a roadmap that has been endorsed, and we met here on the margins of the GA to operationalize that roadmap after the heads of state have endorsed it. I hope that those efforts, and they will address the security perspective, the humanitarian perspective, and the political perspective, each of the neighboring countries utilizing its deep relationships with various sectors of the Sudanese political entities, the military, the civilian component, to attract them to see the importance of ending this conflict, of providing the support to the Sudanese people, and expanding the dialogue.
At this ongoing UN General Assembly, the head of the Sudan National Army called on the international community to designate the RSF as a terrorist organization. If this is done, will this help the process to resolve the ongoing conflict and to bring peace, like you said, Egypt is trying to rally around people to solve?
Well, we are concentrating on ending the military confrontation and providing a format for political discussions between those concerned to reach an understanding that relieves the consequences and pressures on the Sudanese people. That is our main focus in collaboration with the other formats that are involved in the issues related to Sudan. It's important also to maintain the structures of the institutions of governance, the legitimacy and the national state entities as the viable protector of the interests of the Sudanese people. I think we have seen the experience in our region of countries that have imploded and that have fragmented and do not have institutions of government that can represent the country and provide services to the people and to their citizens.
That was the Egyptian Foreign Minister Hassan Shawki. He spoke with my colleague Peter Cloti recently on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Cameroon's Minister of Foreign Affairs is the latest African leader to call on the United Nations to grant the continent a permanent seat on the UN Security Council during his speech to the UN General Assembly yesterday. VOA's Carol Van Dam has more.
Like other African leaders before him, Cameroon's Minister for External Affairs, Lejeune Mumbela Mumbela, called on the African Union to be granted a permanent seat on the UN Security Council.
I wish to reiterate our support for the reform currently underway within the United Nations and the goal of creating a Security Council that is more representative, equitable, and efficient.
African leaders have been pushing for a permanent seat on the powerful UN body for years. U.S. President Joe Biden backed the effort at the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit in Washington last December. Having a permanent seat on the Security Council would, for the first time, give African countries veto power over U.N. resolutions. The Security Council currently has five permanent members: Britain, China, France, Russia, and the United States. The U.N. General Assembly elects other countries for two-year terms. On climate change, Cameroon's foreign minister said COP28, which starts in November in Egypt, must provide urgent and decisive answers for the survival of the planet. He says the international community must raise funds to help developing countries fight the warming of the planet. He says African nations are doing their part.
Thanks to the forest mass of the Congo Basin, one of the environmental lungs of the globe, the countries of Central Africa, united within COMEFAC, are making a major contribution to the search for solutions to climate change throughout the world.
African leaders have called for debt relief and a large amount of climate financing to help the continent boost its electricity generation from renewable sources almost sixfold by the year 2030. The 78th annual UN General Assembly wrapped up Tuesday in New York. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, on his first visit to Africa about 3 days ago, met first with Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud in Djibouti and praised him for making impressive progress in the fight against al-Shabaab. He also met Djiboutian President and Defense Minister, thanking them both for hosting the United States' primary base in Africa. Heading to Nairobi, he signed a defense agreement with the Kenyan government. And now he is in Angola's capital, Luanda, where our VOA Pentagon correspondent, Carl Babb, is. Welcome to African News Tonight, Carl.
Thanks for having me.
So you are in Luanda. What is the mission in Angola for the secretary?
So the secretary has had a very particular focus in Angola, very different from Djibouti and also from Kenya. Angola and the United States do not have that close ties, and they have been working very hard over the last several months to bring the two countries closer together. And so what the secretary has done today, he met with the president. He also met with the Minister of Defense, looking for ways that they can help that military cooperation increase, including using U.S. equipment. They would like to see Angola start using U.S. equipment and training more with U.S. forces. He gave a speech here in Angola and made some very interesting points. He was calling out the Wagner Group and Russia during this speech, saying that the United States will never take partnership for granted. The people of Africa deserve to chart their own sovereign path. Then Africa deserves better than outsiders trying to tighten their grip on the continent and autocrats selling cheap guns, pushing mercenary forces like the Wagner Group, and depriving grain from hungry people all around the world, of course alluding to Russia preventing grain from coming outside of Ukraine at the moment.
So, Carla, your overall assessment about the Secretary's first trip to Africa, starting with Djibouti, tell us what you thought about the whole thing.
This first tour of Africa has been a very interesting experience. A lot of news made, a lot of important drop-offs, and a lot of important points made along the way, especially talking with the Somali president. He pointed out that there had been more progress against al-Shabaab, the biggest terror group, the biggest threat to the United States in Africa, over the past year than the past 5 years combined. And he said that the United States needs to continue to work with its Somali partners, and he hopes that the other countries around Africa will also help Somalia in their fight against al-Shabaab. Then he went to Kenya, where they signed an agreement, a five-year defense agreement, so they could plan to further cooperate military to military. And included in their discussions was confirmation that Kenya is going to be sending a military police to Haiti and that the U.S. is going to provide $100 million in support of these Kenyan military police, because the United States says Kenya has been a leader in peacekeeping missions across the globe. And finally, here in Angola, the U.S. is looking to build and strengthen ties here. And honestly, it was a very personal time for the Secretary of Defense. He has today visited the Slavery Museum in Luanda, slaves that were taken from Angola to the United States centuries ago. Now have a common thread, he says. He said, I am a child of America's segregated South. I grew up in a time of legalized racist segregation in America, and I stand here today in Africa as America's first black Secretary of Defense. He was telling Angola that democracy may not be perfect, but democracy is the way to grow, not with military coups, not with autocrats.
Carla Babb, our reporter, our Pentagon correspondent in Luanda, briefing us on the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's visit. Thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me. You're welcome.
The United States is temporarily stopping assistance to Gabon after the military took charge last month. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a statement the government is pausing certain foreign assistance programs benefiting the government of Gabon while we evaluate the unconstitutional intervention by members of the country's military. Blinken said the United States was maintaining diplomatic and consular operations in the oil-rich Central African country. Gabonese military leaders on August 30th overthrew Ali Bongo Ondimba just as he was proclaimed the winner of an election widely criticized for irregularities. The military installed as Prime Minister opposition leader Raymond Ndong Sima, who in an address to the United Nations last week promised to take steps to hold new elections and called on the West not to condemn the coup without nuance. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. The World Health Organization is calling on schools to protect children from the toxic impact of tobacco use by creating nicotine and tobacco-free zones on their campuses. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than 8 million people die prematurely from tobacco use every year, most in low- and middle-income countries. The World Health Organization reports around half of the world's children breathe in air polluted by tobacco smoke. Of these, about 51,000 children die each year from illnesses related to secondhand smoke. WHO medical officer Kirsten Schott says the tobacco industry views children and teenagers as prime marketing targets, as an overwhelming 90% of smokers pick up the habit before turning 18. She says the tobacco industry entices young people to become new users by providing addictive, sweet, and fruity-flavored nicotine products.
Also, what we see is that these products become more affordable to children, for example, by single-use vape sticks, as they are called. They are more affordable. They usually don't bear any health warnings, and children often don't know that they contain nicotine and are dangerous.
To counter this trade, Schott says WHO has launched a new guide and toolkit for school administrators and teachers on how to create tobacco and nicotine-free schools. These guides, she says, provide best practice examples from countries, cities, and schools on what they have done to become tobacco and nicotine-free. She says schools are in a unique position to create this healthy environment because children spend a third of their waking time in schools.
This is the place where children encounter a lot of this peer pressure about using these products, and this is why it's important that schools provide this safe and healthy environment for children.
The WHO guide highlights four ways to promote a nicotine and tobacco-free environment for young people. They include banning nicotine and tobacco products on school campuses, prohibiting the sale of e-cigarettes and other tobacco products near schools, and banning the advertisement and promotion of tobacco products near schools. The guide also calls on schools to refuse sponsorships or engagement with tobacco and nicotine industries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The renaming of a major road in Johannesburg has divided opinion in South Africa. Yesterday, the African National Congress-led local government renamed William Nicolle Drive to Winnie Mandela Drive to honor the late anti-apartheid hero. Darren Taylor reports.
Winnie Mandela is still called the mother of the nation for her lead role in fighting racial discrimination in South Africa. She was the face and voice of the struggle against apartheid from 1964 to 1990, while her husband, Nelson, was imprisoned by the white nationalist government. But she's also remembered for leading a gang in Soweto that terrorized the community, sometimes torturing and murdering enemies they labeled apartheid collaborators. Mandela also encouraged her fellow South Africans to kill anyone suspected of cooperating with white authorities using the necklace, in which a tire is filled with petrol, placed over the victim's body and set alight. In 2003, she was convicted of more than 400 counts of fraud and theft related to government contracts. But at a ceremony along the newly renamed Winnie Mandela Drive yesterday, none of this was mentioned, as her great-granddaughter Zenawe took the podium.
I'm happy to know that from today on, every time the road is mentioned in traffic reports, written on the addresses of residents and businesses, my great-grandmother's name will be acknowledged. I would like to thank my great-grandmother's political home, the African National Congress.
Paul Berkowitz, director of the Third Republic NGO, isn't opposed to renaming the road. He says he's opposed to the way in which the ANC did it.
There's normally supposed to be a consultative process that would follow the ambit and the spirit of the Municipal Systems Act, and even as high as the Constitution, which talks about political participation and community inclusion. And that hasn't happened yet.
Berkowitz says the technically illegal renaming of the road is just another example of the ANC riding roughshod over its own laws. He says the name change is going to cost many millions of rands, at a time that the city of Johannesburg argues it hasn't got money to repair broken infrastructure that's causing widespread water outages.
And we can argue over whether name changes are important or not, or whether they cost money. But for me, what's more serious is that during the budget preparatory work, the mayor and most of the mayoral committee was missing in action. So this is just the latest ad hoc decision taken by the city of Johannesburg without consultation, without consideration, while the street is...
Berkowitz says residents have been waiting for the Minister of Water to address their water problems, but the mayor isn't there. Spokespeople for Johannesburg Mayor Kabelo Gwamanda didn't respond to requests for comment. But Gwamanda previously said it's wonderful that the city now has a major route named after Winnie Mandela. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The International Coffee Organization says Kenya is the fifth largest coffee producer in Africa. But like farming communities around the world, Kenya's coffee farmers are being increasingly squeezed by climate change, price fluctuations, and now a real estate boom. Francis Ontomwa reports from Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
This is Kiambu area, nestled south of Nairobi, a cornerstone of Kenya's coffee industry. But with massive harvests from India and Indonesia flooding the market, prices are down. And some farmers are getting out of the business of farming and becoming landlords instead. Modern houses now stand where coffee bushes once thrived. And farmers like 57-year-old Joseph Ndongo believe it's the only rational choice to survive in today's economy.
Coffee is now being overtaken by the real estate because, one, real estate has a good earning. You are getting this money every month. In the coffee, you get it. This is a perennial crop. You'll get it once in a year. So you see real estate is more better than doing coffee or tea.
Just a few years ago, these lands were covered in thriving coffee plantations. Now towering apartment buildings have taken their place with billboards advertising land for sale at every turn. Stephen Joroge chairs a local farmer's factory but contemplates his exit from coffee farming. He says they're not being paid commensurate to their efforts as farmers. He says he invests so much in planting, harvesting, and uses his own capital, but at the end of the day, he doesn't get anything out of it. He says it's frustrating. Most local farmers' cooperative societies are in disarray, like the Gadhuirini factory, which serves over 700 farmers. Coffee beans sit in sacks collected from farmers several weeks ago, but have yet to be collected by the millers for processing, says Samuel Masharia.
Cooperatives are dying out of loans because there are so much loans that were taken when coffee was a big business. And now that the production has gone down, cooperatives are finding it difficult to meet and pay these loans.
Some economists like Vincent Kimosop say the cooperatives need better leadership and government support.
Address the governance issues in those areas so that those who are practicing in the space could actually gain and benefit from such a practice, because demand for coffee is still there. And you can see there are countries that have gotten it right, like in the Latin Americas, that are able to reap foreign exchange, employment creation, and they contribute significantly to their economies.
The Kenyan government says coffee production in the country has plummeted from about 130,000 metric tons annually in the 1980s to only 50,000 metric tons in 2022. Francis Ontomwa for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, Thanks for choosing The Voice of America.